You're listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. I'm Pamela Wu, in for Beth Ruyak. Deirdre Walenik took on the sport of climbing in her late 50s. In her 60s, she became an extreme athlete and has now climbed some of the toughest, most famous California terrain, Half Dome and El Capitan. Climbing is a big thing in her family. You may have seen her son's story in the Academy Award-winning film Free Solo. Deirdre herself has navigated a lifetime of challenges, which she writes about in her new memoir, The Sharp End of Life, A Mother's Story. She talked with Insight host Beth Ruyak ahead of the book's release this coming Wednesday.
Welcome to Insight, Deirdre. It's good to have you in the studio. How do you introduce yourself to people at this stage of your life?
Well, it depends who they are. If they're climbers, you know, we meet and I say, I'm Deirdre, and we talk for a while. And usually somebody says, you look familiar. Because I've been in a lot of videos over the years, and now, of course, I'm in the movie, Free Solo. And so somebody invariably says, you look familiar. Have we met? So I just say, yes, I'm Alex's mom.
Alex being Alex Honnold.
Yes.
But there's just one name needed now for him in the climbing world.
Right. There are a lot of good Alex climbers out there, Americans and Europeans. But Alex is probably the most famous right now just because of the movie.
Because your book has the subtitle, A Mother's Story, it's obvious that that's a very powerful identity and credential for you.
Yes. My main job in life.
Let's talk about your two children, your oldest. Mm-hmm. And in the book, she's an inspiring force for you. She's an accomplished marathoner, an extreme long-distance bicyclist, mm-hmm. and just an all-around impressive person.
Stacia is a force. She's a real force, and she's just a joy and an inspiration, and always has been.
And Alex, the youngest of the two, what do we say about Alex as a child in reading your book? At the very least, you were racing to always keep up with him.
He was different. He was different from birth. I didn't have a whole lot of experience with kids when I had him, but enough to know that. Yeah, I mean, I could go on. I could write another whole book about that. In fact, this book started out to be about raising Alex.
At some point in this conversation, we are going to get to that question that everyone wonders about. And you know the question is...
Yes. How can I stand it?
Yeah.
How can I sleep at night knowing what my son does for a living? Yeah, I always get that. How would you like to be that kid's mother?
So we'll get to that in a moment, but I don't want to miss your story and the way it starts in Queens in the 1950s, growing up in a Polish family, Polish being the secret language. But talk about your mom's situation, because those circumstances from the get-go, I think, shaped a lot of what your life became.
Yeah.
She had had polio
as a baby. Yeah, my mother was a victim of that huge polio epidemic in the early 1900s. She was born in 1915. So she had polio, a lower body. There are two different kinds. If you have an upper body, you had to live your life in an iron lung. So there were a lot of things she couldn't do. And, you know, having babies was her big conquest. So she couldn't carry us. She couldn't run after us. So I guess it was impressed on me from the very beginning of my life that, you know, we had to be extremely obedient. If she called, we had to go running. Nobody could chase after us. And this is pretty different from most child raising, you know. So we had a very thought out set of rules for us, you know, both my brother and me. And of course, I was the girl, though, so I got all the fun stuff, all the chores. You know, the boy was king. In Eastern European, you know, mindset, boys are king.
The expectations on you as the daughter in the family were quite different.
Quite different. Totally different.
I would say that the next big leap in your life was into your marriage. Certainly things happen in every person's life between childhood and becoming a spouse. But you moved into this marriage with Charlie, the kid's dad, and that is a whole centerpiece of your life in what I see as the wrestling match between who you were and who you would become.
Exactly right.
I want to read a paragraph about Charlie that I think says a lot but raises a lot of questions. This is pretty early on in the book, and you wrote, When Charlie was a child, no one had heard of some of the disorders or syndromes we now know people can suffer from, like autism, obsessive compulsive disorder, or attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. I wouldn't learn about them myself until years later, when some of my friends had little boys whose behavior seemed to mirror my husband's. But back then, as we whirled through each day, my main job, besides caring for my children and our home, was to do whatever was necessary to avoid an outburst, to appease. Old habits die distressingly hard.
Pretty grim.
How conversational have you been with the kids about the struggles before the book came out? Because you wrote about the interior of your relationship in a way that sometimes only husbands and wives really navigate or know. Yeah.
They didn't live at home through most of it, you know, so we didn't really have time for heart-to-heart talks. So not much, but they're very, very bright, and they're very observant. And they lived with this. They knew what was going on far before I even started thinking about doing anything about it. So I didn't need to tell them. They knew.
There were definitely some adjectives that are apparent in reading about him. Charlie was brilliant.
Yes.
He was not emotional, but he was very engulfed in whatever was in his world.
Yeah, well, his world was travel. He was probably obsessive compulsive or whatever you want to call it, but his entire focus was on travel. So anything that fed that was wonderful. And if it didn't feed that, he was morose and shut down, basically.
He accomplished a very interesting new pathway in teaching from a distance, which allowed him to go to Yosemite, which connected...
Which fed his travel mania or whatever.
And the family experiences. Did he sort of create that out of his own mind? Let me teach online from a distance?
Yes. He didn't like people. He didn't like being around people. When he walked into a classroom, that was a little bit different because it was ESL, so all those people there would talk about their countries and their experiences. So that was travel in a way for him. You know, that was an escape. But yeah, he just wanted to be by himself. He just wanted to be alone on a mountainside and teach that way.
Someone might think that because he was there and the kids spent a lot of time in Yosemite and climbed a lot, that that actually spawned Alex's talent or his accomplishment.
Not his talent.
No.
That was innate. He was born climbing. I mean, he could stand up the day he was born, which is ridiculously impossible. But he had immensely powerful thighs. The first thing that everybody said when they saw the baby the first day he was born was, what big hands he has. He had massive mitts for grabbing, and he had powerful thighs. And, you know, if you put him on your lap, he could just stand up. Just for a second, you know, but he could get himself vertical. That's all he ever wanted to do from birth. So nobody had to teach him how to do that.
How old was he when that first big climb happened in France?
He was almost 11.
Would you mind reading a description of that climb from the book?
Sure. What's that? I asked Genevieve. Qu'est-ce que c'est? The unusual geological feature shot straight up from the flat ground around it, a 300-foot-tall phallic-looking spire of cream-colored limestone. C'est le monolithe. My stomach clenched as she said it. I vaguely recalled Philippe talking about le monolithe, where they would climb today, the monolith. I know the meaning of mono and lith. How could I not have put that together? Could that be the same one where... surely Philippe wouldn't have... surely I hadn't agreed... Words failed me in both French and English. I was mesmerized and horrified at the same time, drawn toward it as moviegoers at a horror movie are drawn to the gore and blood, knowing terrible things are going to happen, but continuing to watch nonetheless. The others were instantly forgotten. I hugged my jacket around me and walked alone to the base of Le Monolithe. It loomed over me, blocking out the sun. It blocked out everything but my fear. Philippe and Alex were so high already that I couldn't make out their faces. This was my own damn fault. I should have asked specific questions, details. I just left everything up to Philippe. Never again. If my son lived through this, if I lived through this, I'd never make that mistake again. But he had assured me that the climb was at Alex's ability level. Regardez! Look, look. People had been strolling the trails near the base of the climb, and they'd had begun to notice the two little splotches of color high, high up on the side of the rock. I kept walking around its base, slowly, my neck sore from craning upward. I'll never forget that day.
That was the first big climb.
It was his first outdoor climb ever. Yeah, he'd only been going to a gym for a year at that point.
Could you even imagine or envision what might be ahead? What do you think when that's your 10-year-old up on the side of the mountain?
No. I didn't think I was going to survive that day. I'd never seen anything like it. I had never seen outdoor climbing at that point. I didn't know it was a sport. Knew nothing about it. I didn't have any time to spend wondering about it or thinking about it or doing anything about it. I did nothing but work for that whole period of, their childhood to adulthood. Basically, I just worked many jobs all the time because I lived alone, basically, with my two kids.
Was Stacia already at that point showing signs of extreme adventureness, extreme athleticism, extreme curiosity?
We didn't think of it as extreme. We just all loved to hike. We knew that Alex loved to climb stuff. I knew Alex was more stubborn than anybody could possibly stand. He had this tenacity of spirit from babyhood. He could out-argue anybody except me. And Stacia seemed to have that too when she'd go running and biking. But they were just kids. Nobody thought about it as extreme. It was just what they were like.
Every mom knows that there are choices along the way. Do you encourage them and let them take risks?
Right.
Do you hold them back and risk breaking their spirit?
Right.
Did you debate some of these
questions? Oh, heck yeah. All the time. I got lots of advice from other mothers, when I hang out waiting for kids to get out of school. Everybody could see how busy and active and physical Alex was and how different. It's not that he was hyperactive or anything like that, but he was just had no limits. He'd just keep going. He would stay up until his body just caved in and fell asleep standing up. He just did not want to stop. And they'd be up at 4:30 every morning. Go, go, go. He was, limitless in his ebullience, his enthusiasm for life, whatever you want to call it. But a lot of mothers gave me advice like, you should take him to a doctor, get him diagnosed or something, or get a drug to slow him down, or put him on Ritalin, or things like this, or put him in gymnastics. That was a good one. And I did try that, but it didn't work. The other kids liked different things than Alex did. And that was hard for many years because I knew there was nothing wrong with him. He was just a great kid. He had his quiet times, his down times, and we talked about everything. We sang, we read books, but he liked something different than everyone else liked. We didn't know anybody else who climbed stuff. And so he didn't fit their parameters. And so everybody had advice as to how to make him more normal, to fit their own description of what normal is. And I didn't buy into that. I could see how normal he was. In our house, he was wonderful. He was a wonderful boy. So, when I was little, I never let myself buy into these ridiculous limits that are put on girls, especially girls in Eastern European upbringing. According to my parents, there were three things I could do in life. I could be a nurse, I could be a teacher, I could be a secretary. And that only until some man came along and then took care of me for the rest of my life. I didn't want a life like theirs. I didn't want a life like my Aunt Helen's. The Ritalin and the there are other cures that they suggested, that wasn't for Alex. And I knew that. But it's hard to fight that all the time. So, yeah. I just had to try not to let it wear me down.
You're listening to Deirdre Walenick. Her memoir is titled The Sharp End of Life, A Mother's Story. Could I talk with you about the transition at the time of the divorce from the kid's dad? And I'm just going to keep this simple and say that there was a divorce and then Charlie died of a heart attack. Mm-hmm. What I'm really interested in is how that changed your sense of self, your sense of freedom and place in the world, Deirdre.
My sense of everything was changing for many years before that, as I figured out what to do about that kind of marriage where I lived alone because he lived alone. It's hard to figure that out while you're working all the time and dealing with two wonderful children. 1 month after the divorce became final, he died, dropped dead in an airport. That kind of changed everything immediately because I had to handle his estate. And at the same time, I was remodeling 3 houses on the East Coast and 1 house on the West Coast. Just lost my father, who had lost Charlie's father, my mother, not too far prior to that. Trying to keep the kids on an even keel because they had just lost their dad. And a few months later, they almost lost Alex. That was another horrible story that's in the book. Kids were not really involved in it because they were not there physically. Although I had just divorced Charlie, so I couldn't actually authorize anything on the estate work. I wrote all the estate work. I wrote the documents. But I couldn't actually sign anything because I wasn't his wife anymore. And then I would make a pile of that stuff that I had written or found or researched. And then that weekend, I'd call Stacia and say, sign this, sign this, sign this. She would sign everything as next of kin.
You mentioned Alex's accident and just a harrowing phone call that from him. I don't want to read it from the book because you can tell the story. I had to reread it a couple times to figure out what's happening here.
Yeah. Living it was like that, too. I said, what's going on here? Is he really here?
Maybe to set this up, we had talked about the fact that you had just gotten cell phones for everybody for Christmas.
Uh-huh. Yep.
And that's why he had a cell phone with him when mm-hmm. he had an accident on the mountain.
Mm-hmm. He only had it with him because Verizon made a mistake and sent me the wrong phone. And Alex liked that kind better than the one I had chosen, so he took it with him. The down parka I had just given him had a little pocket for cell phones, and if not, he probably would have left it in the car. You know, a lot of little coincidences or angels or whatever you want to call it. And a lot of details went into making that an amazing story. You know, this is the day after Christmas. You know, Stacia's asleep down the hall, and I picked up the phone, groggy from Christmas Eve, and hello, mother. I'll never forget that. It sounds like he was doped. But he doesn't do that. Everybody knows that Alex doesn't drink, he doesn't smoke, he doesn't do any of that stuff. Where am I? Why am I all covered in blood? At that point, I almost dropped the phone myself. And he had taken a horrible, horrible fall from the top of Mount Tulak, which is almost 10,000 feet. In the middle of winter, the Tahoe region, it was a huge storm that had blown in from Alaska. He wasn't expecting. Just sent him sailing down the mountain. He finished in a pile of boulders, head first, broke a lot of bones, had a concussion. He was
and
a mess.
What you were hearing was hypothermia setting in. So it became a race against time to save his life from freezing to death.
From freezing to death, right. Exactly.
So with cell phone technology, the pings helped rescuers.
And they would ask me, because I gave the phone to Stacia, told her, you know, keep him talking. Don't let him fall asleep. And I talked with the search and rescue people, and they kept forwarding questions to him. What does he see to the north? What does he see to the east? And he was compass mendus enough to answer those questions.
You go into great detail, of course, about learning to climb. And Alex was your coach, your teacher, a guide on the mountain. I also want to include that there's this paragraph here that involves Stacia and mm-hmm. what she was doing. And I'll read it quickly. Stacia was 23 when she ran her marathon. I was 55. I went on to do 3 more. I get it now. Stacia made me believe. Until that day, I was a bystander. Now I was running toward a new life. I understand why the car decals given out at the marathon say, I believe in 26.2. I used to think that was just hokey marketing. Now I know it really is all about believing. Your book, Deirdre, is full of so many examples in which you are propelling your children, your husband, your parents, your life forward. The turn in this for me was hearing the ways you describe your daughter and your son propel you mm-hmm. and how you mm-hmm. let them, how mm-hmm. you trusted mm-hmm. them enough to mm-hmm. let them.
They were wonderful. It would be very, very different without them pushing me to discover what I could do. All through that period that I call that the black hole of my life, leading up to divorce and then the death and then the aftermath of all that, and throughout that period, I would see them coming and going and having a wonderful time following their passions, being fulfilled. These things made their life rich. And I could see this happening. And I wanted to know what that was like. I wanted some of that. I hadn't had any of that with Charlie. And so I started jogging a little bit here and there. And Alex's take on things is, I guess you could call it encouraging. If you can do one, well, then you can do two. You can run a mile with the dog, I guess you could do a mile and a half. And so I did. And then he'd come home and tell me, well, wow, cool, Mom, now you can do two. And I had never lived that way. I had never been encouraged to. So I started leaving the dog home because the dog was too slow. Couldn't go as far as I wanted to go. And I signed up for my very first road race. It was the Run to Feed the Hungry here in Sacramento. It was an outrageous goal for me. 6.2 miles. Can you imagine running 6 miles? But I was almost up to three. But, well, it's a good cause. Something my kids would embrace. You do good for people, and you have a good time, and you further your goals, as it were. And Alex ran it with me. He decided to run it with me against all odds because he was just came home the night before from Europe from a climbing competition. And so he came in at like midnight from a 12-hour flight and got up at 6 in the morning with me and went to do the Run to Feed the Hungry. That changed my whole life. That was the beginning of the beginning.
You started climbing in a gym and then moved to outdoor climbing. In 2017, at age 66, climbing with Alex, and you make a point to say, and climbing with ropes.
Yes.
You became the oldest woman to summit Yosemite's El Capitan.
I did. I didn't know it at the time. I was just doing it because I wanted to do it. Alex was willing, so up we went.
What has climbing done for you personally, beyond the relationship with your son?
I learned a lot about digging deep. I mean, I knew how to dig deep emotionally. I could deal with anything and had. But doing it on a physical level was different. I've always been kind of active. I rode my bike on the weekends and go ski a few times a season, not with any regularity and just a little, just to be sociable. But this was something else. This was a lifestyle, and it was immensely rewarding on so many different levels. Climbers go to the most gorgeous places. And the only way to get there and see that view is to climb up there. And nobody else will ever see that view. Tourists will never get to a lot of the places I've been. To see what you are capable of when you think you can't go another step and then to do it is like, ooh. Kind of like Alex's take on things. If you can do one, you can do two. If I could do this mountain, like when I climbed my first big wall, as they call it, Royal Arches. And all the while we were coming down from Royal Arches, I was thinking to myself, I just did a big wall. I wonder if I could do that other big wall down the road a piece, It's a question of increments. I had never learned to push my own incremental growth physically, and this is an amazing experience, all of it.
Deirdre Walnick has lived an accomplished life. She is mom to daughter Stacia and son Alex Honnold. Okay, Deirdre, sounds like you couldn't have stopped it. How do you live with it? How do you live with what he does, knowing that in any moment his life could end, his life could change?
I had many years to get accustomed to this thought.
To get conditioned to the risk or the thought.
Right, right. Not only the risk, but to comprehend fully what he was capable of. That's the largest part of this. I mean, everybody who looks at the stuff he climbed can see the consequences right there. The risk depends on him, only him. What shape he's in, the weather, the conditions, how he feels, if he slept enough, if his skin is right for that kind of climb. And I needed to learn about that. That's mostly why I started climbing. Now anymore, I love it myself. But at the beginning, I just wanted to know what he was up to out there. I didn't really know. When he started going off on expeditions and things, I had no clue what climbing was, what happened when they went out there. So I had to learn to trust his judgment. All parents, to a point, have to learn to trust their kids' judgment. They're going to make a mess of it, or they're going to make a go of it.
How many times have you seen the movie? How many times have you seen Free Solo?
Oh, maybe 10.
Do you shake your hands out like everybody else does in the middle of it?
Yeah, the first time was very hard. Even though I know he makes it, took me a few tries before I actually mastered it, shall we say.
Well, it's a remarkable ability captured in an Oscar-winning documentary, mm-hmm. and now life and adventures continue on.
They do.
Congratulations. I'm not saying it about the book. I'm really saying
about
it.
About life. Thank you. It's been a long haul. It's been an uphill struggle. So now we're ready for fun.
Ready for fun. That was Deirdre Walenick talking with Insight host Beth Ruyak about her new memoir, The Sharp End of Life, A Mother's Story. We have more of their conversation and the dates of the author's upcoming appearances in Northern California at our website, capradio.org/insight. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Capital Public Radio.